The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, President Biden makes a dangerous and ill-advised statement on Israel.
What I'm calling for is for the Israelis to just call for a ceasefire.
We'll hear from Victor Davis Hanson.
And then what happens? Well, we know what happens. Hamas comes out of the bunkers. They say, we defeated the Jews. Here we are.
Former President Trump delivers a position statement on abortion.
The states will determine by vote or legislation or perhaps both.
Marjorie Dannenfelser of the Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America responds.
Human rights don't stop at the borders of states.
Plus, the Arizona Supreme Court issues a decision on abortion. Kathy Herod of the Center for Arizona Policy.
That pre-roll law said that abortion was not legal unless necessary to save the life of the mother.
We've got all this and more. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And follow me on X at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program, please, as well at Town Hall Review. Town Hall Review is part of the Salem Podcast Network. We're going to begin with Israel and its battle to defeat the terror group Hamas. I want to start by playing for you what I believe is the dumbest thing of consequence. It's a subcategory of dumb things. The dumbest thing of consequence that President Biden has ever said. And I've been listening to him for a long time. This is the dumbest thing of consequence. He was interviewed a week ago by Univision.
I think what he's doing is a mistake. I don't agree with his approach. I think it's outrageous that those three vehicles were hit by drones and taken out on a highway where it wasn't like it was along the shore. It wasn't like there was a convoy moving here, et cetera. So what I'm calling for is for the Israelis to just call for a ceasefire, allow for the next 6-8 weeks total access to all food and medicine going into the country. I've spoken with everyone from the Saudis to the Jordanians, to the Egyptians. They're prepared to move in. They're prepared to move this food in. And I think there's no excuse to not provide for the medical and the food needs of those people.
A total unilateral ceasefire for 2 months. The president told Hamas, don't negotiate because you're going to get everything you need to stay alive in the meantime. Of course, they tried to walk it back, and of course, Hamas heard it. They can't walk back what Hamas heard. You need to remember, by the way, Joe Biden ordered a drone strike on 10 innocent Afghans after we left the country after the Abbey Gate terror attack. This arm-twisting appeasement is both dangerous and appalling. Victor Davis Hanson addressed this shift from Biden on Israel from his podcast.
Blinken shouldn't talk like that. Not only did he say something stupid about a provocative NATO expansion, but he made the moral equivalence of October 7th and Israel, what Israel's doing to eradicate the murderer. So he said, basically, you're becoming more like Hamas. And I don't think he got the message that there was a ceasefire, Mr. Blinken. And on October 7th, somebody violated it, like 3,000 murdering gunmen and a tag along 500 Gazan volunteer civilians, which suggests that Hamas is popular among the civilians and they're intertwined. And they murdered and they raped and they mutilated and they beheaded. They did all of these pre-civilizational barbarities that we can't even imagine. And then Israel waited 20 days. And in that interim, did Hamas say, oh, we're sorry? Or did somebody in Gaza say, they don't represent us? No. They started celebrating. They spit on corpses. They tried to mutilate the dead. They high-fived every time they saw a hostage being transported into Gaza. The architects of that massacre, whether they were in Qatar, another questionable ally, or in Beirut, were bragging that it was just the first volley in an existential war. Oh, by the way, they didn't say, Mr. Blinken should know, they didn't say after they killed the first 700 Jews, they didn't say, well, you know what? This is really kind of barbaric and, you know, let's just have a ceasefire. No, no, they're calling for a ceasefire now, Mr. Blinken, because they're losing. As long as they were decapitating innocent people who were not armed, they didn't want a ceasefire. And then the question is, arises compared to what, Mr. Blinken, since you're now Clausewitz, what's your plan? Do you want them to, what, it's immediate ceasefire, we're told, or what, you're going to cut off arms to the only democratic ally we have in the Middle East? And then what happens? Well, we know what happens. Hamas comes out of the bunkers, and the kingpins of October 7th, they're still alive. They broadcast to the Arab world, 500 million Muslims and Iranians. They say, we defeated the Jews. Here we are. The worst day since the Holocaust. We killed more Jews than any other day since Auschwitz closed its doors. And what happened? I'm still here. They stopped. They couldn't defeat us. And that's going to be a rallying point.
Right.
Given what? Give them another 3 to 4 weeks, they will destroy Hamas. And then they'll be discredited and they will be humiliated. And maybe if Iran hasn't used Hezbollah to strike, they'll be very, very wary. Because once they destroy Hamas, they'll turn their attention to the border where there's 100,000 displaced Israeli citizens. And I think Iran will not want to use its other pawn, Hezbollah, because they remember what happened in 2006 in Beirut. And so this is very important that we don't do that. And if we can't make the moral distinction between a democratic ally who is retaliating to a pre-civilizational attack on its own civilian population at a time of peace and tries to drop leaflets and text people to get out of the way as they try to rescue hostages and retaliate against killers who are using their own citizens as shields and mosques and schools and hospitals. And we can't make that moral distinction. We who did what? When we left Kabul, remember General Milley, Jack? He said, a righteous strike. Well, it wasn't righteous, Mr. Milley. You killed 10 innocent civilians, 7 of which were children. I didn't fault you. Things happen in war. That's the tragedy of war. Nobody's hands are clean when you get into a war where civilians are interspliced with terrorists or killers, whether it's in Vietnam, whether it's in Fallujah, whether it's in Mosul, whether it's in Tokyo on March 11th, 1945, whether it's in Hamburg, whether it's in Stuttgart, 1944, just the way a war is.
Yeah.
But it's very different than going out and trying to cut somebody's throat. And the Israelis are not doing that.
Victor, as a historian, you pointed out, here's a war that can be won, right? In Israel,
yes.
And Ukraine is clearly a war that cannot be won.
And I wrote that. I wrote this this week, Gaza, that my new column, and I said, this is we have left Verdun territory, and now we're getting into the Battle of the Somme. We've left 700,000 dead, wounded, and missing at Verdun, and now we're getting up to 800 to a million Russian and combined Ukrainian casualties in a catastrophic fashion. Every week, I won't mention names, but even some of my colleagues at the Hoover would say, well, they're going to win. It's just a matter that it's going wonderfully. No, it's not. In contrast, Israel is winning. And you give them 6 or 8 weeks, they will get rid of Hamas. And they've already got rid of about 75% of the people who planned this. And they've got the names of everybody, and they're going down the list that participated in that. They've got that from informants. They got that from prisoners they took, except they got it from surveillance, and they've got it from videos. And if we will let them do that, they will do a service to humanity in getting rid of Hamas. And it's tragic about all the collateral damage. It was tragic in Mosul. It was tragic in Fallujah. It was tragic in Afghanistan. It was tragic in Vietnam. But when the enemy deliberately tries to shield killers, you've got a moral dilemma. And Israel has killed fewer civilians per militant than any force that I know of. It's about 1.5 to 1. I think we were about 3 to 1. And in World War II, you know, it was even higher. And we really outdid them on the propaganda war. And our guys in Europe and the United States on campuses, they were disruptive. They were obnoxious, but it didn't matter. They were effective, and they're threatening the election, and Biden's weak. Now he's begging the Saudis for more oil. He's begging the Ukrainians not to hit oil sites in Russia. He's terrified of a Middle East war that will put the price of oil well over $100 and he'll lose. We've got him where we want him. That's what they're thinking right now.
Yeah.
And all the appeasement in the world won't stop that. And then if he keeps doing it, Hezbollah will really ramp it up. And so I think that's very dangerous what Blinken is doing. He's inept. So he's I don't know who's worse. I mean, Jake Sullivan said right before the October 7th, not right, but if remember, the right. My portfolio is kind of, you know, it's just quiet. It's the quietest. There's nothing going on in the Middle East. Well, there was nothing going on because you inherited it from Trump. And then you did what? You took away the terrorist designation of the Houthis. You begged to get in the Iran deal. And what do you expect? You started restoring funding to that corrupt UN organization that funds Hamas and the Palestinians. And they thought, well, the good old Biden is back. He's like Obama. He doesn't like Israel. So if we go do something after the initial little, how dare you attack our ally Israel, he'll tire real quick. And they were pretty prescient, weren't they?
Yeah. One last thing for me, maybe our listeners feel the same way. This disdain, this outrage over the deaths of 7 aid workers last week in Gaza, and the intensity of the outrage by American officials doesn't seem to track I still never sensed any outrage over the murder of Americans on October 7th.
And I don't either. That's a really wonderful point. I mean, they have American hostages. Why didn't Biden say on October 7th in the evening after he got the news, he could have easily said to Hamas, okay, you've got X number. I don't know what there were, 15 more. I don't know. You've got American hostages. These are U.S. citizens. Now, we're giving you 48 hours to release them, and we're not responsible to what happens to you after that. That's all they had to do. They didn't have to make a red line like Obama did. If I see, the Syrians moving WMD around, that's a red line. Well, we know how that happened. They did it, and they laughed at them. They didn't have to get specific. They just said, we're not going to be responsible to what happens to you. And that could have been expressed in a lot of different ways. They could have just said to the Israelis, go to it. They won't give our hostages back. Go to it. Or they could have sent special forces, or they could have done a lot of things. And they could have looked at Iran. They could have gone to Tehran, and they can say, listen, these people don't sneeze without your permission. Now, you're going to get those hostages back. And by the way, screw you. We're not going to pay $1.2 billion for 6 hostages. But what we are going to do is give you a deadline. And these are the targets that we're going to look at. And I think they would have had a lot more success than they have now had they done that. Even with that administration that lost all credible deterrence after Afghanistan.
Coming up, former President Trump's statement on abortion.
The states will determine by vote or legislation or perhaps both.
When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Stay with us.
This is Dennis Prager, and now a truly exciting new benefit, my monthly online video get-together for PragerTopia Plus members only. For an hour each month, get an exclusive chance to ask me anything. I'll be answering your questions. I've never done this. Submit your questions for me at PragerTopia.com. This is our chance to connect like never before. Go to PragerTopia.com or click the banner at DennisPrager.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. It was June of 2022 when the Supreme Court released their Dobbs decision, ending, blessedly, the era of Roe v. Wade. It was a monumental moment. Yes, monumental in the history of the court and of constitutional law. But it also has had an enormous impact on the political landscape. As we've watched the pro-life cause set back in a number of states in the 2 years since the decision was released, former President Trump made a statement early this week.
My view is now that we have abortion where everybody wanted it from a legal standpoint, the states will determine by vote or legislation or perhaps both, and whatever they decide must be the law of the land, in this case, the law of the state.
John Solomon, and Amanda Head, turn to Marjorie Dannenfelser of the Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America from John Solomon Reports podcast.
I know that there are differentiations between your stance and what President Trump said, although it doesn't seem to me like there's really a vast gulf. Talk to us about that.
So the first statement that he made about this being a states-only position, I do take, and the pro-life movement takes, great differing opinion with, and that is that this is human rights don't stop at the borders of states. This is not a matter of geography. It's a matter of what is deep in the DNA of who the human being is. And so to have a federal minimum standard at late-term abortion when a baby feels pain, they have fingernails, they have fully developed organs and eyes and fingerprints, and they are so what we're looking forward to for a baby, a healthy baby and a healthy mom. That is a very popular and consensus position in this country. And it's a pro-choice position even in this country, and it's a pro-life position. It just doesn't please both ends of the spectrum. And so where a difference of opinion is that it's a states versus federal position. Where we definitely agree is that Roe versus Wade, because of his efforts, led to his defense of all those justices, led to the overturn of Roe, turn it back to the states and every legislature, including the Congress, to get to consensus in all of those realms. And so I think it's an enormous mistake in terms of where the pro-life battle is, but it's more about a human rights battle and where incrementalism is. And I also think that it's a politically misplaced place to put your marker, because the other side is for unlimited abortion. This current president is so lacking in compassion where he would draw the line, meaning nowhere. So the contrast between nowhere and a 15-week or somewhere around there late term when a baby feels pain is a contrast. It's a winning contrast politically. And so that's where we were hoping he would land. He did not, but I still have hope.
So, Marjorie, one of the things that wasn't in the speech, but I assume will be forthcoming, is making clear that the president opposes federal tax dollars for any abortion practices, procedures, support. Do you expect that in the weeks ahead? And is that important to solidify not only his base, but where he really stands on the issues?
Yeah, I do expect that. I think in his first administration, he made certain commitments. Yeah. That was one of them. He made a commitment to a 20-week limit at that point, a federal limit on abortion at a consensus place. He committed to stand by pro-life Supreme Court justices and federal judges in general. He made really strong commitments to that point. And I think some of those we will see again, because they're basic conservative principles. I think that where we would like to see some progress, and I actually do have hope, is that he would match that commitment that he made formerly in his past administration on a gestational limit with some sort of limit at some point late in pregnancy on the federal level, which would be a not only the politically smart thing to do, but also the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Margie, I just want to ask the hard question and have the hard discussion, because, I mean, yeah. I think that Europe can be used as a cautionary tale when you have a hardline stance on abortion. You know, their pro-life movement in a lot of countries in Europe has kind of fizzled out to the degree that it hardly has any footing. How do you balance that with making sure that you win seats so that you have Republicans in Congress and in Washington so that the pro-life movement doesn't just totally fall away?
I'm glad you brought up Europe, because in Europe, 47 out of 50 European nations have a limit on abortion 15 weeks or earlier, and most of those countries have it at 12 weeks, because they didn't have a Supreme Court like we did that put a cap on consensus in the country and an ability to develop law in the country that was based on the will of the people. Now, we just got that. So we have high expectations about what we can do quickly. But I think what makes sense, and I think what the is to look at the polls, the will of the people of this country, what even pro-choice people say, what suburban women generally say, what we see in battleground states, is that if you take a position of limiting late-term abortion as a federal minimum standard versus what the current president says, which is there should be no limit, that's a winning position. You've got a 70 versus 10% position, and the rest don't know what they think. But that is a winning position in every other political issue. The question is, why on this issue, why would we not follow the basic rules of politics and stake out our positions in ways that make rational sense with a rational international contrast. And I think it's just basic fear of the A word. And that evidenced itself as soon as Dobbs happened. And we had an Ostrich strategy in the Republican Party in general that led to defeats in 2020 because we got $500 million spent against us, about $50 million against, with no candidates really on the federal level except for J.D. Vance and Rubio saying exactly what they thought in terms of contrast. So I think you can expect losses when you don't raise money and you don't provide a contrast. And I think if this is the case moving into this election, we predict there will be losses again because you've abandoned the benefit that this issue provides you. And that is a wildly popular late-term limit versus unlimited abortion.
Abortion was in the news in Arizona this week, as their state Supreme Court released a 4-2 decision upholding an 1864 law restricting abortion. Kathy Herod of the Center for Arizona Policy explains for us in her conversation with Seth Leibson on AM 960, The Patriot in Phoenix.
The Supreme Court of Arizona could have gone a couple of different ways because there were a couple conflicting laws. Why don't you take it from there and describe to the people what happened?
Sure. Arizona has what we call a pre-Roe law, and this was the law that was in effect on January 22, 1973, when Roe v. Wade was handed down. That pre-Roe law said that abortion was not legal unless necessary to save the life of the mother. It had actually been upheld as constitutional by an appellate court in Arizona. Then Roe comes down, and it makes that law not constitutional under the U.S. Constitution. So for the almost 50 years of Roe v. Wade, the statute, it's 13-3603, no abortion except when necessary to save the life of the mother, that was unenforceable. So Roe gets overturned, and so then it becomes an issue of, well, what's going to happen next? When the Arizona legislature in 2022 passed a law limiting abortions to 15 weeks gestational age, but in that law, they did not repeal this 13-3603, so that law was intended to mean that if Roe was still the law of the land, then 15 weeks was the limit on abortion in Arizona. Abortions were only legal up to 15 weeks. But if Roe was overturned, then the 13-3603, the pre-Roe law that had not been repealed, would again be in effect. So today's decision, it's very important to note, was one of statutory construction. It was the court deciding, would it be the 15-week limit or would it be the pre-Roe law? And the court today upheld the pre-Roe law as being the one that's how the legislature constructed the law, and that it's not any kind of constitutional decision.
Right.
Coming up.
In fact, it took a while after Roe v. Wade to realize how extensive the court's decision was.
Juristocracy, when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. I start every day by reading through the stories at Daybreak Insider. In just 10 minutes, I can zip through 10 stories that help me start my day and help shape where I go with the Mike Gallagher Show. Over 250,000 people get Daybreak Insider by email daily, and it's available to you at no cost. Go to daybreakinsider.com and simply plug in your email. That's daybreakinsider.com. In 5 minutes, you will be the most informed person in the office. That's daybreakinsider.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The critical role of an independent judiciary. It is foundational to our nation and to so much of what we've discussed thus far in our program today. Yet the role of the judiciary is rare in the history of humanity. And no, it is not a universal feature of democracies. I was at the campus of Hillsdale College this past week. Had a great conversation with Professor Paul Marino, author of How the Court Became Supreme: The Origins of American Juristocracy.
Let's talk directly about your book, How the Court Became Supreme: The Origins of American Juristocracy. And I'm going to use that. I've never heard it before, but you denied credit for it, which I salute your humility. Where did juristocracy come from?
Americans really invented it. Article 3 of our Constitution was unprecedented. There'd never been such an independent and separate judiciary. The idea of a third branch of government was a relatively new idea, really Montesquieu's in the 18th century, just generation before the founders. So there were peculiar historical circumstances in the late 18th century that made Americans confident that an independent judiciary would help liberty.
And do you agree that they were correct in their premise? And Federalist 78 was well-reasoned?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely brilliant. Marshall uses it in Marbury Against Madison to defend it. And still, I think, a classic and logically, you know, irresistible statement. If you're going to have a written constitution, which was also a new thing, and that constitution is supposed to limit what the government can do on a day-to-day basis, judges have to hold the one up against the other and see whether they square with one another.
A limiting principle of the court is that they only decide the case before it, and they only go as far as they can, and they uphold a statute wherever possible. I defend the Obamacare decision by the Chief Justice for as long as it has existed. And Mark Levin thinks I'm a rhino as a result. And Mark is a very fine constitutional scholar. I've been teaching con law since 1996. What did you think of the Obamacare decision?
Well, actually, I called it, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal when I was coming. I said it's a constitutional no-brainer. The court will overturn it easily, and I was wrong. And partly that's because, and I should have known this as a historian, you know, there's a lot of water under the bridge where, you know, considering Commerce Clause cases generally, where since the New Deal, Congress has been able to regulate everything because everything is commerce.
Rickard. Yeah.
Even Justice Thomas said, you know, I'd like to get back to the original understanding of the Commerce Clause, but there are what lawyers call reliance interests. You know, there's too much water under the bridge.
Yes.
And I think Roberts was recognizing that. And yeah, I can.
Reliance interest did not make Roe super president. Thank God. And now it's on the front pages of every newspaper in the United States. Your appearance today, Professor, is well timed because the Arizona Supreme Court has asserted its right to interpret Arizona's law. Of course, the left is pulling their hair out. And it's actually not going to change very much in Arizona because it's already very restrictive and people can get an abortion to save the life of the mother. And I imagine the legislature may ease that up on the rape and incest exceptions, which are common. But what do you think of states taking back their role as the police power arbiters in their states?
Yeah, I think from the very beginning, opponents of Roe versus Wade, that's all they wanted. In fact, it took a while after Roe versus Wade to realize how extensive the court's decision was and how completely the states had been taken away their, as you call it, the police power to regulate safety, health, welfare, and morals. And the constitutional position that, you know, this is should be a matter that's left to the states. Republicans, since Ronald Reagan, I think, have proposed a constitutional amendment to make this national, but, you know, that's not going to happen. So in the meantime, I think the proper constitutional view is to leave this to the states.
Now, Professor, I also argue with my friends often, I'm not sure there is a basis in the Constitution to regulate abortion on a national basis. They argue with me with a variety of ways, but what do you think?
Well, I mean, if you accept the idea that a constitutional amendment can do anything.
Well, no, I'm not doing right. within the confines of the Constitution.
No, and I would be opposed to, I mean, apart from things like, you know, military installations and places where the federal government does have a peculiar, you know, power.
How about the chemically induced abortion, which is an FDA? I say that's okay because it's the FDA.
Yeah, and there have been, you know, because we went through this with alcohol before Prohibition. Where states, some states were dry and some states weren't, and how could the dry states prevent people from importing, you know, liquor into them? And that's why there's an exception in Section 2 of the 21st Amendment that repealed it. So this, yeah, that is a very narrow technical point.
I haven't seen your new book yet. Is it a historian's view of how the court ended up being the court? Do you begin in 1776?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I go back to antiquity. The idea of the idea of the law, the idea of having judges. In fact, I look at the Book of Judges in the Bible, and I end there too when I tell the story about the Israeli Supreme Court today. The first two chapters are sort of before there's a Supreme Court trying to set up the Constitution and then set up Article 3.
Now, I believe an expansion of the court will be the end of the rule of law,
mm-hmm.
because that which gets rewarded gets repeated. So if they expand the court, and I also have an argument that it might not be constitutional, although the 14th Amendment does not pass until 1868, and so and the court expanded last after 1868. And so what do you think about expanding the court?
It's a bad idea. 9 seems to be something of a magic number. Charles Evans Hughes, when Roosevelt was proposing to pack the court and expand it up to 15 in the 1930s, explained that beyond a certain number, it becomes dysfunctional. You know, there's a good reason why you'd want to cap it.
Coming up, the erosion of the rule of law. Exhibit A, Los Angeles.
But what George Gascon has done is he's decided up front there are certain criminals and certain crimes that no matter what the facts are or the law, that he just won't prosecute.
When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
John Solomon provides exclusive reporting and newsmaker interviews on John Solomon Reports on the Salem Podcast Network.
We broke this story because we got the documents early. They put out this new information, and it affirms our reporting that this Democrat donor gave about $5 million or more in assistance to Hunter Biden, basically paid off his bills.
Subscribe to John Solomon Reports today on Apple, Spotify, Google, Rumble, or at SalemPodcastNetwork.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. An independent judiciary and respect for the rule of law. The two notions are both foundational for the flourishing of freedom and an ordered civil society. Both are at risk, or at least straying, as our nation approaches our 250th anniversary. Respect for the rule of law has been pretty well abandoned by non-prosecutorial DAs like George Gascon in Los Angeles. Our friends at AM870 The Answer in L.A. had their big event last weekend, the Conservative Summit. Jennifer Horn and Grant Stinchfield moderated a panel with local DAs, Jason Anderson, district attorney in San Bernardino County, Mike Hestron, DA in Riverside County, and they included Nathan Hochman, the candidate running in L.A. County, looking to unseat Gascon. We picked up with Nathan Hochman.
On day one, we stopped putting criminals' interests first, and we put victims' interests first. And the power of the DA in Los Angeles can allow us to do exactly that. The DA does not answer to the mayor of Los Angeles. They don't answer. He would not answer to the Board of Supervisors. George Gascon proved, because he did it within the first hour he was in office, that you can change these policies and then, in my case, change them back. And again, we're not going back to the policies. And Mike and Jason are perfect examples of how a DA should operate in their county. Because you're not going back to blanket extreme policies on one end of the pendulum swing, or the George Gascon decarceration policies on the other end. You go back to where prosecutors have always operated, in the middle, which is an individualized look at each defendant and their background, the crime committed, the impact on the victim, which we've forgotten about in Los Angeles County, and you figure out who the true threats are to our public safety and need to be behind bars, and quite honestly, the ones that aren't. The first-time nonviolent offender still has to be held accountable for their actions. But that might be the case where you give them community service or a diversion program and hope they never come back in the criminal justice system. But what George Gascon has done is he's decided up front there are certain criminals and certain crimes that, no matter what the facts are or the law, that he just won't prosecute. He's inserted a political agenda instead of doing the two things that Mike and Jason and all great DAs do, which is look at the facts and look at the law. And if they violate the law, you cannot pretend that they didn't. You prosecute that case accordingly, and that's what we'll be doing in L.A. come November 6th. But my values stayed the same, focusing on victims, not criminals, being in primary concern with people's safety, and not just their own safety, their family's safety. I mean, what we've seen in L.A. is that people are voting with their feet. They're actually leaving L.A. County. They're going to Riverside or San Bernardino, Orange County, or outside of California in general. They're voting with their feet because they look at safety in our county going in the wrong direction, and they say, I have enough with that. My response is their response. Enough is enough. And we're going to get George Gascon out of office and bring back accountability.
Now, one more George Gascon-related question for you, Mike Hestron, and you, Jason Anderson. We know that Todd Spitzer, who is also a fantastic DA in Orange County, has actually taken out billboards. Don't LA our Orange County. Don't commit crimes in Orange County. You will be prosecuted. He literally had to take out billboards. How does George Gascon, a very different style DA than you, Mike Hestron, and you, Jason Anderson, how does that impact your counties? Does it make it harder?
It does make it harder. So the crime problem in Los Angeles County has spilled over into Riverside County. It's just plain and simple. Los Angeles is lawless. The streets are lawless. I mean, if you've been to downtown LA, it looks like something, post-apocalyptic in some ways. You know, it's bad. George Gascon, I think he and others like him, call themselves progressive prosecutors. There's nothing progressive about them. The word progressive would denote that something's going to get better. He hasn't made anything better. He's a rogue prosecutor. He's a prosecutor who puts defendants and criminals first and doesn't care about victims or law-abiding citizens. That's not the role of a prosecutor. The role of a prosecutor, as Nathan talked about, is to seek justice in every single case, not make blanket pronouncements about which laws are going to be enforced and which laws are not going to be enforced.
Tell me your first day.
First day. You would reverse the special directives that George Gascon issued on his first day. Amongst those special directives were literally for juveniles, he will not prosecute a misdemeanor theft offense. And it's funny, you might have seen on Fox News and whatnot, on January 2nd, there was a 13-year-old who took a Kia, backed it into the iron grate of a store called Ruben's Bakery, which had been in Compton for 48 years, a family-run bakery, took down the iron grate, and over 100 juveniles ran into Ruben's Bakery and ransacked the place. I talked to the owner, Ruben, and he can't believe it. He said this isn't the first time this has happened. He sees a lot of the juveniles committing the crimes, committing more crimes. He doesn't say law enforcement has given up because they know that if they arrest any of these folks, not only are they going to be let out immediately, the DA will decline the case because he said up front he's not prosecuting juvenile misdemeanor theft. So we can reverse that on day one and send a message to three important groups that are in L.A. County or, for that matter, in any county. First are the prosecutors. There's 800 prosecutors who work for George Gascon, and they are so fed up that 98% of them supported his recall. That's fed up. I mean, imagine if you were running a business and 98% of your employees thought you were doing such a bad job that they wanted you fired or resigned. Generally, people would hide their head and walk out the exit door. George Gascon looks at that as a badge of honor. The second group is law enforcement, as you were saying before. Law enforcement in L.A. is incredibly demoralized. It's already a very difficult job. It's very expensive to live in L.A. It's very dangerous. And when you don't have the DA have your back, and not just your personal back, but you work up these cases and the DA declines them over and over again, you're either going to leave and find Riverside or San Bernardino a much more warm environment, or you're going to struggle and hope that there's a change, and hopefully I'll be that change.
Do you have the ability to start asking for bail again?
Absolutely. The system in L.A. County, again, George Gascon started out saying, look, he wants zero bail for everything but the most serious offenses. He sent that message to the court. The court adopted a system that effectively is zero bail for everything other than a violent offense. So if you even get arrested for a smash-and-grab robbery, you're arrested in the morning and your friends will see you on the street corner in the afternoon. That's L.A. County. We can reverse that. The DA's office can go into court, petition to have magistrate judges inserted earlier in the process, present the information that a particular person, like a recidivist, someone who's done it over and over again, should not be let out in the streets, and make that pitch to a judge and hopefully convince the judge. Right now, George Gascon's hands off, and his prosecutors are literally pulling their hairs out.
Coming up, more with the DA panel and the rule of law.
Do you want four more years of George Gascon? Do you like the way safety is going in Los Angeles?
In the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Please stay with us.
Charlie Kirk here. It is critical we keep AM radio in all cars and all trucks. More than 80 million Americans depend on AM radio for news, weather, and opinions. AM is also the backbone of the emergency alert system, keeping you advised of threatening weather conditions and amber alerts. Text AM to number 52886. Tell Congress that we need AM radio in our cars. Again, text AM to the number 52886. Standard message and data rates may apply.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Wherever you are in the nation, I hope you tuned into those down ballot offices like district attorney in your community. Hard to overstate how much of a difference a law and order, no nonsense district attorney can make. And even in blue states and liberal metropolitan areas, the average citizen is fed up with rampant crime. People don't feel safe. Candidates like Nathan Hochman in Los Angeles can win. Let's pick up with Jennifer Horn and Grant Stinchfield with the panel of DAs.
What are your biggest challenges? What are your words for people today to kind of help improve their situation, or in your case, Nathan, get you into that office in November? We can start with you.
So in the primary election we just had, George Gascon got 25% of the vote. That means 75% of the people rejected George Gascon. And that cuts across, thank you, it cuts across political lines, demographic lines, geographic lines, all up and down Los Angeles County. My job and my opportunity and my honor, to be quite honestly, is to unify that 75% of opposition. And that's exactly what I'm going to do. So I'm going out to every different type of organization across the county. I'm going out to the prosecutors, law enforcement, victims groups, survivors groups, all the different ethnicities throughout the county, and basically taking to them the question, do you want four more years of George Gascon? Do you like the way safety is going in Los Angeles? I said, please don't even think about moving to Riverside or San Bernardino yet. Give me a chance. And November 5th is that chance. We expect, hopefully, 2 more million people to vote in the November general election than voted in Los Angeles County in this last primary. And we're going after all 2 million of them. And again, hopefully I can overcome these challenges. It's not going to be easy. George Gascon's not going to go down quietly. But we have built an army of people to take him down, and we will.
Thank you. Jason Anderson.
What I would encourage is everyone who's here today obviously is very committed to the rule of law and to public safety. You need to continue to talk to your neighbors about why it's so important at the local level to stay involved with your local legislators. We also have to have an honest discussion everywhere about the ideal that somehow the criminal justice system treats a certain segment of community unfairly, because what we're doing is we constantly get in a discussion about comparing data that's not similarly situated. I don't know why we always get into a discussion where we compare people who continually commit crimes versus people who never commit crimes. I want to say that again. So when you talk about disparity, I want you to think about this number. 70% of the prison population are made up of men. 30% of the prison population are women. In 2022, our census indicated that the majority of people in this country are 50.5% women. Does that mean that we stop filing 20% of cases against men who are committing crimes, or do we just make up 20% charges against the 30% of women? No, we compare similarly situated individuals. I really get frustrated when law-abiding people are compared to people who commit crimes, and we shouldn't have those discussions.
Thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. If you enjoyed the program and the podcast, do us the favor of sharing it with a friend. Let me point out, you can get this podcast, Town Hall Review, John Solomon, Victor Davis Hanson, and my own podcast, all at the SalemPodcastNetwork.com. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubin, producers David Pouchon, Alex Perez, Adam Ramsey, Harley Eide, and of course, Wayne Patterson. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.